So welcome. The second meeting of the Subcommittee on Child Care Access and Affordability will come to order. And there is a quorum present. So do I have a motion right now to approve the minutes from January 11th, Wayne Kwong, Representative Kwong?
Madam Chair, I so move.
All right. Representative Kwong moves the approval of the minutes from January 11th. Any additions, corrections, or changes? All right. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes from January 11th are approved. Last week, we heard from the folks at DHS about the Child Care and Development Block Grant. And today, we are going to follow up with the conclusion of that presentation next week. Yeah. Today, we're going to hear from Marnie Warner at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, who has published statewide research about the child care provider shortage. And we're going to welcome Ms. Warner now. If you could please state your name.
Yes. My name is Marnie Warner, and I'm the Research Director at the Center for Rural Policy and Development in Mankato. And thank you for having me here today. So do I need to lean right into this or? Okay.
No, you can just talk right. We can hear.
Okay, thank you. So the Center for Rural Policy and Development, our particular focus is rural Minnesota, of course, and so we work on various issues. And one in particular that came to us is the child care shortage. And so we released a report this last fall on that issue, and we found some important findings, and this is the basically a summary of that article. So as you can see on this first slide here, this is current licensed capacity, or not exactly current anymore, as of April 2016. These numbers do change frequently as the DHS updates them. And so at the time, this was current licensed capacity in the light green on the pie charts. And the darker green is the shortfall in the number of spaces needed to accommodate the estimated number of children under six with both parents working. And the total number is the estimated number of children in each of those regions, number of children under six. So the percentage then is the growth needed in licensed child care capacity to fill that shortfall. And as you can see in each of these regions, there is a considerable shortfall in each area. Family child care providers, this is where we see the big shortfall. And Minnesota is basically tied for first in the number of households with children under six who have all parents in the workforce. So that defines the demand for child care. In the last 10 years, the number of licensed in-home family child care providers decreased by 27% across the state for loss of over 36,000 licensed spaces. The number of new providers is dropping, and as people are leaving the business, very few are coming in to replace them. I had a recent number from DHS. In the last 10 years, the number of new licenses issued for family care providers has decreased by 45% about. And so that is a substantial number down. Now, on the other hand, we have center-based providers. And over the last 10 years, the number of centers has increased by 8%. And the capacity has grown by 27%, which is enough to cover about two-thirds of the shortfall created by in-home providers leaving the business. But the thing we found in looking at this data more closely is that statewide numbers mask a large difference between the urban and suburban areas and greater Minnesota. On these two charts, this tells a pretty significant story here. The numbers or the lines that are dropping precipitously there, those are the family child care providers. And this is the number on the left, the number of providers over the last 10 years. On the right is the capacity or the number of spaces that they're licensed for. And you can see that in both in Greater Minnesota and in the Twin Cities, that number has dropped considerably. Above the line is the center-based child care. And in on the left, you see the Twin Cities. In the Twin Cities, the number of child care centers has gone up. But the number in Greater Minnesota has stayed virtually flat. And on the right, in the capacity, the Twin Cities capacity has gone up by almost a third, by 31%. In Greater Minnesota, that's gone up by 18%. Now, that sounds okay, but when you look at this particular table where you look at the actual numbers, you can see in the Twin Cities the capacity for center-based child care is enough to make up for the family child care capacity that's decreased and then some. In Greater Minnesota, however, the center-based capacity net change, the growth, has not made up at all for the loss in family child care. In fact, it's left about 15,000 spaces short over the last 10 years. As you see, most of the growth has been in the seven-county area. While capacity due to centers grew in Greater Minnesota, did not make up for the loss of family providers. And Greater Minnesota is far more dependent on family child care providers. About 90% of providers in Greater Minnesota are family child care providers, compared to about 77% in the Twin Cities. And it's simply a fact of economics that daycare centers are much more difficult to open in more sparsely populated areas, just because of the, if you go by the standard business model, there are a lot of upfront costs to a child care center. And it is harder to recover those costs when you open one. Why are FCC providers leaving? A lot of it has to do with income. Well, a lot of it has to do with the baby boom generation, as everything else, they're impacting this as they retire. Subsequent generations are choosing other better-paying options. There are far more options for women now in careers, and the pay, frankly, in child care is not that great, and providers can't make a living at it. I've found again and again in conversations people telling me that they were unable to cover the costs of providing child care at rates that parents are able to afford. This is a problem, especially in Greater Minnesota, because your average family income is much lower in many parts of Greater Minnesota than it is in the Twin Cities. And expenses for child care or providing child care are not necessarily any lower. Regulations are also an issue. They've been tightened in the last several years, partly due to federal regulations. I heard a lot of issues with inconsistency in enforcement by county licensors. I've heard some providers saying anecdotally that they found their licensors in their counties difficult to work with, while in other counties those licensors seem to be fine. Training requirements, of course, increased from 8 to 16 hours a year. Everyone I talked to agreed that more training is good, but it can be very hard to access in rural areas. It involves a lot of travel time, often overnight stays, and having to close the daycare for a day or two. Classes can be canceled because of low enrollment, and that can make it difficult for providers to get their annual training in. And, of course, weather is always a factor. There's also a lack of trainers in rural areas. Now, fortunately, many organizations in Greater Minnesota, in particular the Initiative Foundations, are stepping up and working on making sure that training opportunities are more available and more affordable for providers in Greater Minnesota. certain age groups are hit harder by this shortage, of course. Low-income households, and I should add in here, single-parent households in particular, because they simply don't have that second parent to fall back on if there is a problem with child care. Children with special needs, minority households, and non-English-speaking households. You can see the table on the right shows the percentage of families in a DHS survey that was done in 2009 that said they feel they have to take whatever form of child care they can get. And so you can see how it affects the different groups. I heard over and over again that infant care is extremely difficult to find for everyone. That's just a rampant issue, and the waiting lists are very long. Now, of course, this has an impact on business, and in particular in greater Minnesota, where we're seeing a real shortage in skilled workers in particular. Many companies, especially manufacturers, are searching for those workers and are having a hard time finding them. And so when they do find one, they feel they have, you know, they have scored. But when the potential employee comes in for an interview, if that employee has children, they will, of course, ask about child care. And if it's not available, more and more employees are finding that they are, or employers are finding that their recruit then has to decline if there's no child care available. Child care is a top reason for absenteeism, and that adds to lost productivity and overtime, and, of course, just takes away from the bottom line of the business. And parents who can't find suitable child care may simply choose to quit work and stay at home. This, of course, really presents them some opportunities for businesses to start taking on this issue themselves. Some of them are deciding to start their own child care services and offering that as a benefit to their employees. And, of course, that then adds to their ability to attract new workers. Communities are also looking at tackling this issue on their own. They are grouping together, forming co-ops, organizing amongst the city, the county, local nonprofits, religious organizations to figure out this problem. And we're seeing that in some places across Minnesota. And the quote there is from Dave Wolf, who is the CEO of Gardenville Cooperative Telephone Association in Brandon, where they have a population of 480 people. And he decided that they needed to start a daycare when they moved to that community and found that there wasn't any child care in town, and that was going to present a problem for his employees. And so they took it upon themselves to open this daycare, and they are now serving, I think, about 20 children, and they have plans to hopefully be able to double that capacity. But he feels very strongly that businesses do need to take an initiative here and be leaders in this issue.
I actually know Mr. Wolf very well.
Good. We had a number of recommendations in the article, and these were just some of them. The main one is be careful of looking at statewide numbers when it comes to growth in child care centers, and don't expect that to fix the shortage, because it is simply not, doesn't work quite that easily in greater Minnesota. The region is far more dependent on family child care, and child care centers in the traditional model are difficult to open because of the startup costs. You need a critical mass of children to be able to produce enough revenue to be able to recover those costs in a certain amount of time. And so it doesn't necessarily work as it would in the metro area. Requiring training for county licensors to ensure that they understand child care regulations and also that they understand how to assist providers in understanding the regulations as well as enforcing them. I mentioned this the last time I was before this committee, that county licensors are the provider's first contact with the state, particularly in greater Minnesota, where you may be 200 or 300 miles from St. Paul. And so providers really look to the licensor to be able to help them understand the regulations to ensure that they are following them properly. And so They would really like it if the licensors could all understand that and work in that role. And then to review the regulations thoroughly and look for instances of where there is overlap or where subsequent rules have caused basically overcomplication, contributing to frustration for providers. And that is my presentation. Thank you.
Ms. Werner, by any means, when you did your survey, were there any specific regulations that come up?
Madam Chair, I would have to think about that for a moment. There were actually, I sent Laura the other day some regulations that were mentioned by a United Way person in Brown County about them. There are all the regulations surrounding infant care, of course, were ones that were mentioned as adding to complication, overcomplication. The number of children that providers could look after in particular age groups and in combinations. One thing that this person in Brown County mentioned was that there is a regulation on the combination of children that you can have in a room together, and they were asking that before and after regular school hours they be able to keep children of different ages in a room together so they didn't need so many staff people to look after all of them. The issue of staff is a real problem, just trying to get staff people, and so the number of children that are limited per staff person appears to be something of an issue, although providers understand the importance of that. But that does complicate matters. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for you at the moment.
So, Ms. Werner, there wasn't anything specific regarding family home child care?
There were, but they don't come to mind right now. As we have a very small staff. I'm mm-hmm. basically the researcher. And as we do one project, I move on to the next one and haven't been able to go back and review child care adequately. But I can find examples for you.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the report that you did put together. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Werner? Vice Chair Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I just have a few questions, and if you don't have the answers, that's fine. I just it just sort of made me think of, well, what about this? So do you have any way to measure people who are actually just doing child care in their home that are using family and friends that aren't necessarily regulated, or was your scope strictly with licensed care centers and in-home centers?
Madam Chair, Representative, this was looking specifically at licensed child care because that's where the state data is. I'm not sure if DHS has a way of tracking unlicensed child care, but we were just looking at licensed child care.
Okay. And then do you have any breakdowns by age within the ones that you studied?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't believe we had that in the data. Well, yes, I did have that in the data that I received from DHS. It wasn't put in the article, and so I can't bring it to mind right now.
Yeah, no problem. And then, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, you know, if the expansion of all-day kindergarten and the other pre-K maybe affected the demand for in-home child care as well?
Ms. Warner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that did come up, and the issue was that because of the rate structure and the cost of caring for different age groups of children, infants are the most expensive to care for, and then you have toddlers, and then you have the older 4-year-olds. And as one person told me, providers lose money on infants, they break even on toddlers, and they make money on four-year-olds based on their rates. And so the creating four-year-old pre-K kindergarten would have been potentially a real problem for providers because it would have taken out that group of children that providers could make money on, and so it would have caused an even greater pressure on the cost.
Thank you.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Warner, I know in your report that you had recommended raising CCAP rates. It's not mentioned here, but could you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. I heard in many cases from people who work with providers and are work closely with this that CCAP rates simply don't cover the costs, and they haven't been raised or have been raised very slowly over the last few years and aren't keeping up with costs. And also there is apparently a considerable waiting list of families looking for CCAP coverage. And so that was, if that could be at least addressed and looked at as an issue to help cover that. The problem was that providers who take families who use CCAP would be paid, you know, through the county, that CCAP rate. The family is then technically supposed to cover the difference between what they get in CCAP and what it costs the provider or the provider's rate. And families either oftentimes couldn't afford to pay that rate or that shortfall or were unwilling to. And so then the provider basically was left with losing money. And so some providers were choosing not to take families with CCAP, or they were just taking those families, but were knowing that they would probably lose money on those children.
Madam Chair, thank you. So is the recommendation then to increase provider reimbursement rates? And is there, I can't remember specifically if there's a number that you landed on, or if it's sort of just generally that would be a more of an incentive for families to, or for in-home child care to take more families who access the child care assistance program.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're as a basically a nonpartisan, non-political organization, we try not to make too specific of a recommendation. So we wouldn't include a specific number in there. We would, however, recommend that the CCAP issue be thoroughly reviewed and especially look at the income differences between Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities. In some counties, the median income is considerably lower than what it is in the Twin Cities, and that's the median income, meaning that even families that might not be considered low income are going to have a much lower income than in the Twin Cities area, and just to make sure that difference is well understood. I'm not sure off the top of my head if Greater Minnesota counties are more dependent on CCAP than they are in the Twin Cities, but I think for Greater Minnesota it would be a good idea to at least review CCAP thoroughly and look at that income issue and see if some changes are warranted for it.
Thank you, Ms. Warner, and I do believe that the department next week, when they continue their presentation, we had to postpone it to next week because the governor's budget was coming out and we didn't want to have the department redo their presentation. But I do believe the breakdown of all over the count, all over the state regarding different areas of the difference is going to be part of that presentation. Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Warner, can you tell us, is there any standardization of rates or an average of rates that providers charge or licensed daycare centers charge across the state?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would guess not, but I think your next speaker Heidi Hagel-Braid would probably be able to answer that question better, but I think it's probably left mostly up to the individual provider.
Thank you, Ms. Werner. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Werner, I want to go back to your slide where you talk about opportunities for business for just a moment. And I'm just wondering if you are able to kind of expand on Mr. Wolf's business model for providing, I would assume, on-site child care to his employees for his enterprise in terms of what that looks like, in terms of assistance with CCAP rates, or how those interact when a business undertakes that type of responsibility.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. I don't know how CCAP comes into it in this case, since it's a business-operated child care center. It is technically licensed as a family child care because they didn't have the adequate square footage to be licensed as a center, child care center. So I'm not sure how that fits with CCAP. They did go through all the rules and regulations of the setup, and Mr. Wolf had some choice things to say about the regulations that they dealt with. But they basically took a building that they had on the property that wasn't being used and refurbished that and turned it into a child care center. And it is available to the community as well, and besides the employees of the business.
Ms. Werner, what would be your estimation in terms of the annual salary or earned wage for the folks that work at the cooperative, in terms of would they be lower middle income, upper lower income? Where would you approximate the normative annual salary for a person who works at the cooperative?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wouldn't really be able to hazard a guess. It's I didn't ask, and yep, I really couldn't say.
I just want to thank you. On the next slide, Ms. Werner, you talk about a difficulty in going forward, presuming that we're always looking at the traditional model of child care. It's a bit nebulous for me in terms of what that traditional model has looked like, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to expound in terms of what other models might look like, or that our people are thinking about undertaking, and I would have presumed that the business model would be one of those, but are there other ones out there that we are not hearing about that you have come in contact with that, you know, present opportunities for us to consider?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative. When I use the term traditional model, and I was talking about center-based child care in this case, I was thinking in terms of a person decides to open a child care center, and so they acquire the space or the building and do all the work that needs to be done to follow the regulations, which includes having the particular prescribed amount of square footage per child that is all set out in regulation. If the provider is going to feed the children there on site, they do need a restaurant-grade kitchen, which is a considerable cost. And so between the renovations or the building, the new building of the building and putting it in a kitchen and providing toys, curriculum, and staff, of course, is the big cost. A provider is looking at a considerable upfront cost, and to recover that cost in a decent amount of time, because a regular business would need to be able to do that, they need to have a certain number of rate-paying children that the revenue from which would then cover those costs in 2 years or 3 years or whatever time frame they need to make that a viable, sustainable business. In rural areas, you may not have that critical mass. In the metro area, providers in child care centers do have that critical mass of children, and so they are able to charge a certain amount, and this is why child care tends to be more of potentially an affordability issue in the Twin Cities. The provider can charge the rate that they need to cover those costs, and if a family decides, oh, we just can't pay that amount, and they drop out, there's another family standing by ready and willing to pay that, and the waiting lists are a testament to that. In greater Minnesota, you don't have that. And if a family can't pay the price that the provider wants to charge and they drop out, there may not be another family that can step in that can also afford those rates. And so in greater Minnesota, the two big problems seem to be finding staff, first of all, and then just being able to control those costs to the point that families can afford to pay that rate. And so in some communities that I've heard about and have been told by people who live there, they are working on different types of models, or they're working on basically community-based models. They're figuring out how their community can solve this problem. So instead of just waiting around for one person to come in and open a daycare center, the city or the county or a local employer is getting together with a local nonprofit or maybe a church or other religious organization, and they're figuring out together how they can work on these things. I did hear of one place, I don't remember where it was now, where the city is actually adding the cost of training for providers to their bottom or to their budget and helping providers pay for the training to help reduce their overall costs. And out in Clinton, Minnesota, I heard this from a person who lives there, they had four empty churches in the town, and it's a very small town. I don't remember the population now, but they had four empty churches sitting there, and they're wondering what to do with them. Well, a woman stepped forward who had a degree in early childhood education, and she said that she would like to open a daycare center. And so the city and some local nonprofits and some congregations got together and figured out how they could work together to basically get some space ready in one of these abandoned churches and convert it into a daycare center and control the costs to make it a viable business for her. And so they're working on that model right now. And so it's those kinds of creative solutions that communities come up with, which are probably the best way for communities in greater Minnesota to go. And so the trick there is to make sure that the regulations, which of course we want to be tight because we want them to protect children, but we also want to make sure that they're not interfering with these kinds of solutions as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there any other questions for Ms. Werner? Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Warren, just thank you for your presentation. There's some very interesting information. You mentioned a number of things that are explained best by the economic models with whether it's the baby boomers, or you have a very interesting piece here that at one point this is just about pay, that child care providers are looking outside for better pay opportunities and making economic decisions. So I'm wondering, is there a legislative silver bullet in your estimation that would solve this?
Ms. Werner.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreshaw, I don't think there is a silver bullet. I've really thought about this disconnect between the pay and the cost of doing this, and I'm not sure if it's something in the form of an outright subsidy or what, but child care and early childhood education just plain have very low pay,
And I think part of that has to do with the ability of families to what they're able to pay. There are probably other market forces at work, and so there is just plain a disconnect, and I think it's going to be very difficult to figure out how to address that in just using regular market forces. I think there may be it may have something to do with how we value childcare providers. I actually did hear that from people who work with childcare providers, that they felt that they weren't terribly valued in the community and the work that they do. But of course, as they get to be fewer and fewer, and it becomes a more concerning commodity, of course their value will go up. But then the issue will be, will families be able to afford to pay any more for that? So unfortunately, I don't think there is a silver bullet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we have Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Warner. I understand, having talked with providers in several counties and small towns, that we couldn't come up with a silver bullet, but if you have data and information on the creative things that have been done in different instances, this committee could probably generate enabling language and legislation to allow options and flexibility so that greater Minnesota, could provide. Unfortunately, many of the cities have open buildings, underutilized facilities. If we, helped out in such a fashion as, you've got the cafe or a restaurant in town, and instead of having to have the restaurant kitchen in the facility, two doors down is that the restaurant, and a community comes together very good in the small towns, and that cooperative effort of providing, the food, maybe the Chamber of Commerce, the city, or several business owners get together to help facilitate child care, because everybody has, less than 20 employees, but there's a need between five employers. So I think if you've got examples of what's been done, the innovation, the creativity across the state, that we could maybe look at making it easier for others to implement that, so that the children would have that, the parents would have the flexibility, and we could help the economy in greater Minnesota grow. So that's the kind of information that maybe offline you could populate over, and we could look through and see what we could do and talk with the state and agencies, where things could be done. The other thing is, I'm assuming that you've had some interaction with, I'm used to my counties, they've got licensed daycare provider associations, they band together for training. Have you had any interaction with those type of local organizations, and could maybe help us out with understanding how they handle the training and the flexibility, so it's not as much of a burden, so to speak, having to travel and take a day off and rent a hotel room in order to get the required training?
Ms. Werner?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, there are several organizations, in particular the Initiative Foundations, which are around the state, are doing a lot of work with helping. They're working with Child Care Aware to help providers get to training or bring the training to them. And it's proved to be pretty popular with providers, just having this extra opportunity. And, of course, I would be happy to send along examples of where things are, where communities are trying to do things, and in particular where regulations may be getting in the way or could be modified. That brought to mind one particular point that was mentioned by this United Way staffer in Brown County, and that was that She said that she suggested that the education requirements for staff people was too high, especially when it comes to the amount that they're being paid. And so, you know, a well-educated person doesn't feel very inclined to go and then work for a child care center where they're making barely minimum wage. I was told while I was doing the research that providers who have degrees will often just, as soon as they get a chance, they'll go into teaching simply because they'll get paid better and they'll get benefits and things like that. And, of course, in a lot of rural communities where you have companies that are, there are some communities that have, you know, fairly large employers who are desperate for workers and are charging $16 an hour in full, or paying $16 an hour in full benefits to start. And so it's pretty hard for a family, you know, that is maybe providing family child care to, you know, compete with an offer like that.
Representative, thank you. Madam Chair, I'm assuming that soon, you know, in the future meetings, we'll have some of the associations that are involved in helping to provide training, and that can enlighten us. Can we have data from the state? Because when the administration was working on unionizing daycare providers, they had a plethora of information on unlicensed, and we've got great data on licensed. It'd be nice to have similar data for the unlicensed providers. And then we can have a more global understanding of the situation.
Well, Representative Quam, the department will be up next week, and you can ask them that same question.
Thank you, Madam
You're
Chair.
Welcome. Thank you, Ms. Warner. Appreciate your time and for the work that you have put into this, and I hope that you can continue to be a resource in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right, next up we have First Children's Finance. And we are going to be listening to a presentation on the exciting practices of child care providers in Minnesota. I want to welcome you to the committee, Ms. Hagel-Brave. And if you could please state your name and title for the record.
Good morning. My name is Heidi Hagel-Brave, and I'm here from First Children's Finance. All right.
You may continue.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Subcommittee on Child Care Access and Affordability. I'm here today to give you an overview of some of our work and some of the research that we have been providing around family child care operations in Minnesota. If you don't know much about our organization, First Children's Finance is a nonprofit headquartered here in Minnesota, and we work solely on the business side of child care. People who are in child care are there for all of the right reasons. We want them to be nurturing, wonderful folks with our children. But sometimes they move into that work because of their love for children, not because of their desire to be a CEO. And so we help them to manage their very complex businesses by building their capacity to make them profitable. I think one of the things I'd like to tell you about first is our work in Greater Minnesota, in particular around building capacity of child care. This work is cited inside of Ms. Warner's paper that was published earlier this year. The Greater Than Minnesota Project was launched in 2013, and it is a community engagement process where communities are able to create a community solution action plan and reach consensus about the needs that they have surrounding child care and develop innovative community-based solutions to start tackling those challenges. Inside of that project, also, we have documented real-time business solutions, partnerships, and successful business models that are thriving in Greater Minnesota. And I'd be happy to answer questions about that as we move through our presentation. I first want to just give you a little bit of information about the business case for child care. that access to high-quality child care and early education is vital to the productivity and regional economic growth of Greater Minnesota communities. In 2014, 84% of Minnesotans aged 24 to 64 participated in the labor force, including 77% of them who are women with children under the age of six. So enabling parents to be at work and to be productive work at work, high-quality child care is an important factor. Child care has a significant economic contribution in Minnesota. The industry has a revenue of $883 million, which has a spillover impact into other parts of the economy. It generates other business revenue by allowing people to be at work and to be productive at work. This is a couple of different studies that I'm going to cite that are not from Minnesota, but I think do demonstrate the problem and why high-quality child care is so important in regional economies. When parents do not have access to care, we see a prevalence of things that impact the regional economy and business performance in rural communities, including tardiness, the inability to work overtime, not being at work or to be productive at work, inability to work different kinds of shifts at their job, inability to travel related to their job responsibilities, and not being considered for a promotion or the inability to accept a promotion. As we've been doing this work across the state, we have heard in particular from young working women who are mothers that they feel like their jobs are often in jeopardy when they go on maternity leave because infant care is so absolutely scarce. And they feel like they are less likely to be hired. They have great concerns about the about how the availability of care is impacting their ability to work as well. When child care is unstable, businesses actually lose out. And in one recent study, 45% of parents are absent from work at least once due to child care issues, missing an average of 4.3 days. And 65% of parents' work schedules are affected by child care challenges, an average of 7.5 times annually. So you heard a little bit about the financial models of child care, and I want to just expound on that a little bit. I'm going to share with you the results of a data brief that is in particular about family child care, but first I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview of the business model of child care centers and why that model struggles in the context of Greater Minnesota. As you heard, it is really connected very closely to the square footage available in the facility. It is organized under Rule 3, and there are regulations regarding square footage, outdoor play space, toilet sinks, and all kinds of things. Those child care centers are also interacting with multiple licensing agencies, not just child care licensing, building inspectors, fire inspectors, which are local, and Department of Health as they are serving food. So here is an example of a performance model for a 99-seat center. We took the child care center market survey rates for Fillmore County, and we assumed that there would be a startup of a child care center somewhere in the range of $400,000 to $600,000 plus property acquisition. And if you paid employees $9 to $13 an hour and assumed about $200 per month toward a health insurance stipend or payment, we look at the model. It assumes that there are about 16 infants, 28 toddlers, 40 preschoolers, and 15 school-age children. If we fill that center to to 85% capacity, which is probably an industry standard, it loses about $74,000 per year, and it requires a 94% occupancy just to break even. So some of the your first thoughts might be, oh, well, that's just too big for Greater Minnesota, so let's look at a smaller example. So if you assumed smaller numbers, 52 seats, and using the same, we just picked Fillmore County out of a hat. the startup range is smaller. That includes property acquisition. All of the same compensation standards stay in place. We run that same model, and the operation loses $62,000 a year and requires 101% occupancy to break even. So it can never break even. It is an important factor to keep in mind that sustainable child care creates access, and sustainable business models create access to our most vulnerable children. And so when we see child care centers struggling in greater Minnesota, it is a lot around a demand issue and also the cost of operations. Now, this doesn't mean that you can never have a center or that they're not profitable in greater Minnesota. It just means that you have to be very savvy, very creative, and there are great opportunities for partnership. Nothing is impossible, but doing this on your own, assuming all of the debt, is a fairly unstable prospect. So when we look at centers, when we look at their expenses, about 70% of them are associated with staffing. 20% are dedicated to maintaining their facilities, 5% to food, and the remaining piece of the puzzle is everything else. So it is an incredibly complex model that takes a high amount of organization skills and business acumen to manage. When we look at family child care, here's just some basic information. It's organized under Rule 2, and licensing of homes for family child care and group family child care happens at the county level. One of the things that First Children's Finance does is, in our work in building the capacity of child care businesses, is we created a family child care business analysis tool. It does three things. It generates a profit and loss statement for providers. It anticipates their annual cash flow, and we provide with them a complete and thorough business analysis of their income and expenditures. For many providers, this is the first time that they are getting this information, and what I have with you today, or given to you today, is a data brief called Business Practices of Family Child Care, Expanding What We Know. And I want to tell you a little bit about what we know about family child care providers. Inside of this sample, there are 43 providers. We've worked with them from April 2015 to March of 2016.
Ms. Hagelbraith, can I interrupt you for 1 minute?
Yeah.
Representative Albright has a question.
Sure.
Ms. Hagelbraith, I want to go back just because it strikes me as a bit odd from a business perspective. I just want to go through the numbers with you with your performance models, if you wouldn't
sure.
mind.
Absolutely.
In the 99-seat center performance model, you're identifying a startup cost of between $400,000 and $600,000 CapEx. Are you familiar with where I'm going with this conversation?
Keep going.
Okay. So if your CapEx is $500,000, are you amortizing that over a certain period of time? I don't see that in this illustration, and I just want to be assured that you're not taking advantage of the depreciation schedules for property or equipment, or
sure.
even more so, what tax structure you're running under, if it's a 403B, a not-for-profit, or for-profit. So I'm just wondering if you could elaborate in terms of some of the delineation on those questions.
Sure. So this model is general in nature, and also keep in mind that any of those business structures could be at play here, right? So we could be talking about a nonprofit. It could be a 501c3. There could be a 403b. It could be a private owner. It could be a partnership. We could be talking about a sole proprietor or an LLC. All options are on the table. So knowing that, there are all kinds of different financing and depreciation schedules that may be used here as well. These are just sort of general numbers to talk about what it would take to get up and going and why those numbers contribute to a very tough break-even analysis as we look at the operation of those child care centers.
Madam Chair and Ms. Hagelbraith, but in this illustration, though, you're actually painting potentially a starkly more bleak picture
mm-hmm.
of the operator of that center
mm-hmm.
than what might normally be appropriate, particularly $400,000 to $600,000 for the space requirements. You're talking about potentially a per square foot cost of that, which is more than buying or building a new personal residence. And so in commercial real estate, I understand that it is more expensive, but I'm a bit skeptical that for $600,000 that you still are losing $74,000 a year. That doesn't say everything, because you can have operating loss for carry forwards and what have you that don't feed into that. So I'm not trying to punch holes in it, but I'm just asking. It seems like there's a means that of identifying an opportunity here that isn't really playing out in those two slides. So I'm just hoping that might be explained, particularly on your next slide when you talk about facilities only being 20%. Mm-hmm. You're talking about OPEX here. You're talking about CAPEX here. Mm-hmm. They feed each other, mm-hmm. but you're weighting your performance model more on the CAPEX. Mm-hmm. And I'll just leave it at that. And if she wishes to respond, I'm
waiting. Ms. Hagelberg?
Yeah. Thank you. So, yes, they do feed each other. There are two different scenarios there at play. And I think the thing to remember, too, is that we're talking about in the model that you're looking at here, it also includes just CCAP. If you took just the CCAP rates for Fillmore County in this model, there are opportunities for additional pricing, but we wanted to reflect what we see happening in Greater Minnesota is that providers are staying pretty close to that reimbursement rate to make sure that they are able to attract enough families into the center. I think as we kind of go along, we'll come back to these numbers, and I'd be happy to sort of come back as we get toward the farther into the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I want to pronounce the name again.
Hagelbraid.
Hagelbraid. Oh, thank you. And to the testifier, I wasn't going to interrupt, but I'm glad Representative Albright did. And let me just do this before we – here's the caution that I would throw out. I absolutely understand where you're going with this. I think we need to continue to make the case of how economic models can show the huge problem that we have with child care. However, by going down this financial route and leaving it as simple as this, for example, when we look at a 99-seat or a 52-seat and we look at a loss of $74,000, is that a cash loss or a paper loss? Mm-hmm. I have experience doing tax returns for child care providers and know that one of the things that we don't want to do is put this here and walk away and say, oh, you're losing $74,000 a year. However, if it's a paper loss and you're actually accumulating the cash on that and avoiding the taxes or deferring the taxes, you can actually, many child care providers can become very cash flow rich. Mm-hmm. And I'm cautioning you, as someone who knows financials very well, that this may hurt the message more than help it. And so that would be my caution as we go forward. I mean, we talk about, you had one more slide on here of profitability, that included profitability. However, true profitability comes after the provider is paid. So therefore, if you say they have a profit of $24,000 and the provider has not been paid, that is not profitability yet. However, as you know, and I know from doing tax returns with child care providers, you can the tax code can be very favorable to you on how you do things. And so I want to caution us on this, mm-hmm. because if we're going to strictly look at this as a business model and run down this, I do not think we're painting the picture accurately. That would be my caution.
Do you have any comments, Ms. Hagelberg?
Certainly. I think we wanted to just give you some numbers because people talk about why child care centers are not thriving in Greater Minnesota, why there's not more of them. And we hear a lot of anecdotal evidence, but no one talks about numbers. So I wanted just to give you a picture of what startup costs look like you know, to sort of get up and going. There are many more factors at play here. What I really wanted to provide you with was a more full picture rather than just the anecdotal stories that we keep hearing coming out of Greater Minnesota. I also want to let you guys know that probably at our office, we receive 1 to 3 requests from a rural community per week asking for help in developing a child care center. And they're not, they do not have the demand. But as we go back into our communities, I want to build your capacity of understanding what the most viable business models are too, and why that isn't the first one that we should look at. And yet that is the first one that communities who are seeking our assistance look for. And it's just to sort of give you some numbers and to offset that. So absolutely there are many more financial nuances involved here, but it's really just to be able to paint a picture with some numbers and a model.
And follow up.
Representative Prisher.
And I appreciate that. And you and I have the same goal. We need to paint an accurate picture. However, if the numbers that are portrayed are not accurately actually, I mean, for you to take just the CCAP rates, mm-hmm. that leaves a whole side of this equation off. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't just say, take the CCAP, the lowest common denominator of revenue coming in, but yet then apply a very, if you're going to start a child care center, frankly, you better be a pretty savvy business person. So you better know how to tap into the higher rates and how to tap into other families. So I'm just saying, to your point, if you want an accurate picture, yeah. I don't believe this gives it.
All right. Members, moving on, Ms. Hagelbraid.
Certainly. Okay, so let's talk about the family child care data brief. And as I was saying, there are 43 family child care providers inside of this sample. And on average, we were working with those providers somewhere between 4 to 8 months. In the sample, 28% of the providers were located inside of the Twin Cities area. The remaining were from 15 counties across Greater Minnesota. On average, those providers had been in business for 12 years, and most of them worked alone. Only 9% employed anyone inside of their family child care business. And on average, statewide, they served 10 children inside of their family child care operations. When we start to look at revenue, they reported an annual revenue of about $50,938 with a median of around $47,000. 90% of their income is from tuition, and 93% of the providers in the sample received income from the child and adult care food program. And CACFP makes up about 10% of their revenue generation. 30% of the providers in the sample received CCAP, and of those, the payments accounted for 23% of the tuition received. And 5% of those providers received some income from an early learning scholarship. You should also note that in the time period of when we were doing this, it was just the beginning of the statewide rollout of the Parent Aware system, so not all counties had access to those scholarships as we were gathering this data. So that impacts this number. Every provider in the sample served preschool children, and the tuition from preschool enrollment on average makes up about 54% of income tuition or tuition income. And what I think is important to realize is that the importance of preschool tuition for the financial viability of family child care needs to be recognized, especially as we look at universal preschool. Mixed delivery systems are incredibly important to maintain the viability of family child care. And family child care partnerships are critical to maintaining the supply of child care across the state. The primary mechanism for child care delivery in rural Minnesota is family child care. And if, universal preschool becomes something that happens in our state, involving family child care in that system is incredibly important.
Thank you, Ms. Hagelbraid. Yeah. Representative Quam has a question.
It'd be nice to get the assumptions or the aggregate, because you know, 50K, approximately 1K a week, you figure there's a couple weeks of vacation per child, and if you had 10 children, it would be $100 a week. It would be nice to get the actual numbers that so they're taking care of X number of children per the CCAP dollar rate, you know, because I assume it's different for
different
age of child and region, and then the details. It'd be nice to know, because that would tell us what the average occupancy is and information like that. So if you could, you know, offline provide the committee with the guts instead of the, you know, ooh, shiny presentation.
Well, right now I'm going to assume all providers are pretty much full. There's such a demand in child care. When I did child care, I started in June of 2006 and did well for a little bit, and then the market crashed. And then, you know, as providers used to kind of joke that we were looking for a bailout. All these big companies were getting bailouts to stay afloat, and child care providers were suffering because the families were leaving. There was no job. I had families that left for other states, and so that was a really tough time. And now the demand is so great, and yet, you know, I don't think that there's really so much of an occupancy issue, but it certainly is a demand issue for families. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, the main point I was trying to understand the actual numbers instead of the you know, boiled down and cream off the top for the presentation.
Sure. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Quam, an average of 10 children in a family child care is quite high. And so most of them are somewhere between a 12 to 14 range, and that means that they would have to have an employee. So if you remember, the previous slide said only 9% of them had anyone employed, meaning that they're working alone, and that limits how many children can be in their care. And so an average of 10 is quite significant, if that helps at all. So we talked a little bit about revenue. Let's talk a little bit about expenses. On average, providers report about $26,372 of expenses per year, and two-thirds of those for family child care are associated with occupancy. The other category includes a lot of things, but not one of them makes up more than 2% of program expenses. You can see that food and other are rankings second and third. When we look at profit and pay.
Ms. Hagelbreth, Representative Albright.
Yeah. Ms. Hagelbreth, so you just touched on the other category.
Mm-hmm.
From a green eye shades perspective, anything that is higher than 2% certainly draws the attention. So your comment is that nothing in that other category makes up more than 2%.
Mm-hmm.
But what are those things?
Certainly.
By name.
Madam Chair, Representative, they could be quite varying. They could be travel to and from training. They could be professional development. They could be costs for quality. It could be them attending an annual conference. It could be additional curriculum or assessment tools. It is sort of a broad range. And because we lumped them all together is because they were very disparate, but none of them really made up more than 2%. But there are 140 core data elements inside of this analysis. We can happily provide a breakdown of what those are.
Representative Albright?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Ms. Hagelbreth?
Okay. So when we look at profit, as we mentioned before, there's the revenue and the expenses. And so in average in the sample, the profit coming back to the provider is $24,566. So hang on for just a second before you ask more technical questions. The providers also, inside of the sample, report operating an average of 53 hours per week. And when they are operating, that means that the business is in operation 53 hours a week. They are also spending another 12 hours cleaning, managing, doing lesson plans, shopping for food, all those kinds of things to manage their program. So when you add those together and you convert that to an hourly wage, 49% of the providers are making less than $8 per hour before taxes. So let's see what a breakdown of that looks like. And you can see that there's a great range. There at the top of that graph, there are providers who are making $18 an hour. And at the bottom, there are providers who are making less than $2 an hour. That is just a straight calculation of profit and hours. What it does not take into consideration are any of the time, space, deductions that they are allowed inside of their business that may make their position more profitable. It also does not account for any of their own children who are enrolled in their child care operation, which saves them money spent elsewhere for child care. So when we look at comparing the metro to greater Minnesota, this is a graph that you can see on your handout, but here are a couple things just of note. Metro programs, those family child care providers inside of the seven-county metro are making more than $9,000 annually than programs in greater Minnesota. And the difference in program expenses is only about $1,200. The differences in profit are driven almost entirely by tuition rates, and greater Minnesota providers report serving more children on average than providers in the metro. So one of the recommendations that I would suggest are lending viability to the idea that CCAP rates should be based on operating expenses rather than tuition rates charged by other providers in the region. The market would, I think, perform better, and there would be more viability if we saw an increase in CCAP reimbursement rates. A note about quality. Providers with a parent-aware rating are spending more than four times as much as non-participating providers on quality practices. And although that seems dramatic, the quality practices make up just 2% of program expenses. That is one of those categories that is captured inside of that other category. And preliminary results indicate that implementing quality practices costs providers an additional $1.32 per week per child, for a total of $688 per year.
Ms. Hagelbraid, on the quality practices, could you let us know how many additional hours are spent?
I don't know that we calculated hours in this sample. I think it's something that we'll probably, moving forward as we do this annually, calculate. But I assume that also part of that could be held in that additional 12 hours of planning, prep, and managing their business. They may have included some of that in there, but we did not specifically call out quality or hours dedicated to quality improvement as a time allocation.
Yeah, going forward, maybe that would be a nice breakdown of what the basic 16 mm-hmm. hours are,
mm-hmm.
and then the parent-aware quality piece.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just a couple of notes about the sample limitations. All of the metro providers in the sample were participating in Parent Aware, and that was due to a funding source that funded that work. In greater Minnesota, Parent Aware participation was associated with $3,344 more dollars of income for programs annually, and that is attributable to higher tuition rates. But I do think it's important to note that we do not know yet whether it was the chicken or the egg. Did the higher tuition rates make a program more likely to be engaged in Parent Aware, or did Parent Aware enable a parent to charge higher rates? We would need further analysis of that. So moving back to our work in greater Minnesota, using the data is helpful in helping communities to identify innovative solutions that address shortages in their communities. And we've been documenting a lot of things, including community partnerships, private sector partnerships, employer-sponsored care, and fully utilizing all licensing options. There are A, B, and C licensing. As I do work in other states outside of Minnesota, They often note that they wish they had the flexibility that our licensing system allows. It does spur some innovation that I think can be leveraged in greater Minnesota. It's also important for us to talk about attracting millennials to replace an aging workforce. And it needs to be a good balance of policy, sustainable funding to build that good ecosystem and to contribute to the supply of high-quality care. When we make recommendations to communities, these are some of the things that we talk about, that communities need a right-size solution and that they cannot just look at the one empty building downtown that would be great for a child care center. They really need to look at all options, not, you know, get zoned in on just one piece of property or one building. The private sector is an important partner, but they cannot be 100% of the solution. There needs to be good policy and good incentives to enable the supply to grow or to just sustain in some places. Licensors need to be knowledgeable about all licensing options. Some of them are very familiar with the most popular ones. And when we're looking for innovation, some of those other licenses are really the key to building sustainable, viable businesses. And involving all existing providers in the community, they are part of the solution, and making sure that there is strong financial modeling done ahead of time and a broad base of support inside of the community for those projects.
Thank you. Does anybody have any further questions? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just speak a little bit to what some of those incentives can be for local communities?
Sure. A lot of them are being done at the local level. So there are different examples of people looking at all kinds of things. Can they tie economic development dollars, incentive dollars that they're offering to businesses to relocate or start up inside of communities? Can childcare somehow be part of those packages? Or are there the ability to set aside funds, sometimes at a county level or a government agency level, either in human services or often inside of economic development, to be able to incentivize startups to cover the cost of some of the capital expenses to get up and going, or to cover the cost of expansion? There are talks of all kinds of things. People are looking at cooperative models, at sort of shared models of sharing costs, or some private sector folks are just coming up to the table and saying, how can we contribute? We know it's important for our workforce to be able to have access to high-quality care, and they are providing sort of corporate sponsorship, for lack of a better term, of training or events inside of communities to be able to enable existing providers to access the resources that they need to be viable businesses over time.
Thank you. Oh, Vice Chair Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious, you know, you talked about multiple agencies overseeing this, and have you thought about maybe considering having, and I'm just trying to make it easier for the families that are trying to provide this care. I mean, to me, it seems like we could just have one person that might have some more consistent standards so that people aren't having, it seemed like, a lot of different rules in different counties happening. You know, did you ever consider looking at streamlining that, or is that a possibility?
Yeah, well, I don't work inside a state government, so that would be kind of a big job.
Yeah.
but I do think some consistency in application of the statutes is always a good thing. But when we're talking about each county, you know, doing that, that's a difficult task. So I know that there's a lot of work being done on that front with, you know, the licensing division, but I'm not really engaged in that work, so it would be hard for me to speak to it more than that.
Thank you. Ms. Hagelbraid, as you work in other states, are you seeing the same systematic failures in other states that are in Minnesota?
I think that there are some universal issues, and particularly shortages in rural communities is a real problem everywhere. And access to a good, solid professional workforce is also one of the struggles. There are many efforts, both nationally and here, even at the state level, that are talking about workforce issues inside of the early care and education industry. But I do think that there are other states struggling, and there is a large spectrum, but we are not alone in this.
Okay. Anybody have any further questions?
I'm sorry, I don't even say. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. I had asked the question earlier. Can you speak to whether or not there tends to be like a standardization or an average of tuition rates that are charged between licensed family care and daycare centers? I know you made the recommendation when we're looking or considering CCAP that we look at the cost and not necessarily tuition rates, but I think, you know, providers may look at both sides of it. So I'm just wondering if there's an average.
There's not really an average. You keep in mind that every childcare business is owned independently. There are some franchises as well. And they really rely on what the families are willing to pay in their individual communities. So we definitely see higher prices inside of the metro area. The Child Care Aware regional and district offices collect a lot of really good data that's accessible that will give a range or an average for particular areas of the state. But even inside of there, there's a wide variance. And some providers choose different business models where they are trying to create access and they're pricing themselves low in order to ensure full enrollment. And there are others who sort of say, like, I have this premium program and I'm going to charge more for it. And so there's a lot of variety in both family child care and child care centers across the state.
Thank you.
It is also illegal for providers to collude with one another and set prices. So we are not allowed to, like, get together in a group and say this is what we're going to charge or what are you charging? I'm going to raise my rate to match yours type of deal. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. And I apologize. I'm sure my face will be a pinup that you'll throw darts at later.
No.
But I'm going to ask this question. And you've done a nice job. Thank you. Setting aside the CCAP and setting aside that home market, I understand the need for subsidy there on the low-income side. However, I want to focus in on this, and this goes back to the previous presentation we had as well as yours. There's an economic model at play here, mm-hmm. and that is we have parents who are choosing to go into the workforce for a higher income, and left with the decision of what they're going to do for child care. And then we have child care that has to set their rates on that. In between, there's a gap. I understand if you're the consumer, you think you're paying too much. Mm-hmm. And if you are the provider, you think you're not getting enough. Mm-hmm. I absolutely get it. Whose responsibility, I understand the CCAP, so whose responsibility is it to make that gap up?
Can I go break?
Well, I think that's a good question with not a very clear answer. So I think one of the earlier questions was, is there a silver bullet? There is not. I think it is a combination of different strategies that can be very effective. Some of the most effective models that we're seeing coming out of Greater Minnesota are when there are community-based solutions and when there are multiple partners at the table who say, this is an issue for our community. We are seeing a lot of private businesses who understand that it's impacting their bottom line in sort of the hiring and retention of their own employees. Child care is a factor. And so they're saying, what can we do to be like an excellent place to work and retain our own employees? And child care is often a solution for them. And so is it their responsibility? I don't know. But there are definitely a movement toward, you know, paid leave and flexible spending accounts, and all of those small pieces start to add into a bucket that can make a difference. But when you talk about responsibility, I think we have responsibility certainly to make sure that low and moderate income families have access, and that is certainly a job of CCAP. When we're talking about families who are working but still may not be able to afford childcare, I don't know what the responsibility, where that lies, but I think that there are strategies that communities can take on, that entities can take on, but there's not one, you know, I think, resting place. It's a collaboration of efforts that I think are going to make the difference.
Hello.
Representative Krisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. And you're leading me down to some of the things that I have seen. And one of the things that I want to touch on, this is a community problem. We're not making widgets here. And what you have said there is we have to solve this in other ways. And the reason I ask that question is because we seem to be trying to solve this through legislation, through regulation, through economic models, of which all miss the mark, which is at the end of the day, the responsibility is on somebody who has to make the best choice for that family. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's the choice between, do I buy a two-door car, a four-door car, a minivan, or provide childcare access, or stay at home. And all those are tough decisions. I've been through all those. But I caution the committee, and I caution, and you presented some very good information here, but we can't miss the mark here. We cannot oversell this to a population and say to them, this just is going to get solved for you. There are economic models in play here, and once we start to apply those economic models to parenting, I would argue that, and I'll throw it into a financial term, it wrecks the net present value of the child's potential. No further questions.
All right. Well, I completely agree with you, Representative Krisha.
We should do more of that, Madam Chair.
What's that, agree? Let's see. Oh, Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, looking at this with 43 family child care providers, and it looks like it's 22 counties, you're less than two per county. It's less than a quarter of the counties in the state. It'd be nice to understand, you know, we know the seven-county metro. It'd be nice to understand where this data came from. You know, because frankly, three-quarters of the state isn't included. And, you know, some regions are quite a bit different. So if that data could be shared. And again, you know, some actual data as opposed to just the summary.
Ms. Hagelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd be happy to provide the full sort of analysis of the 140 core data elements. This was sort of just highlighting some of those, but it is real data. And as we talked about in the slides, it's a limitation of the sample size as small, but there is not data like this that exists anywhere else in the country. So you do have a bird's eye view of, you won't find this data anywhere else. And we'd be happy to let you dive into many, many pages of it.
Representative Kwan.
Madam Chair, thank you. Understanding that the pool of data, the reliability, the certainty, whether something's statistically significant, and those concerns are out there. So if you have something that could alleviate that, or verify just how, limited of a picture this really is, that would be useful.
All right. Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for this meeting today. We're going to be back next week with some information from the department, along with, I believe, the budget, the governor's proposals. All right. And so with that, the meeting is adjourned.